This is a podcast about Jeopardy.
Hello and welcome to Potent Potables, your weekly Jeopardy podcast where two former competitors bring you recaps and analysis of the week's Jeopardy episodes, a deep dive into a topic inspired by one of those episodes, and a quiz. I'm Emily.
And I'm Kyle. And this is the week of March 11th, 2024. We continue the semifinals of the Tournament of Champions, and then we get into the finals, which, of course, we will talk about. Very exciting games. Good stuff happening this week. But before we get there, let's check in with each other. Emily, how is it going?
It's going all right. My church is lovely, as always, but there's a whole bunch of sort of church-adjacent drama that I just shouted at Kyle about for a while. Kyle has behaved himself perfectly. It has nothing to do with my church-adjacent drama, but I'm...
Not yet.
The plot lines are starting to converge.
That's where it gets really exciting.
Yeah, so like maybe Kyle is going to get dragged into my church-adjacent drama one of these days. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, when you guys move out to Colorado, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I gave Kyle a theological defense he absolutely did not need of including children in the celebration of the sacraments, in particular communion, the Lord's Supper, Eucharist, whatever you call it. But there's a whole bunch. There's a bunch of church adjacent things. I've said church adjacent like 9 times now happening in my world that have me pulling out the Bible and obscure books of church law and minutes of church meetings from 1988. Not kidding, to make my points. So that's fun. And in 2 weeks, our corgi comes home. We generally,
that's right. I've been meaning to ask.
We generally don't use our kids' names on the podcast, but the corgi's name is Loaf.
That's a good name for a dog.
It's a good, yeah.
Especially a corgi.
Yeah.
That's a good corgi name.
Yeah, my daughter got to choose the corgi's name, and she said that when a corgi tucks its little legs under, it looks like a loaf of bread. And as it turns out, this corgi is especially oblong food looking because until we told the breeder the name, the breeder gives each puppy a nickname to use for them, and she's been calling Loaf potato up until she found out his name. So she said he looks like a little baked potato, so I've been calling him potato. I'm like, okay, well, his name is Loaf. And she's like, that's perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. How about you? How are you doing?
I am doing pretty well, feeling much better than last week, so
good.
That's good.
Yeah.
And yeah, things are going pretty well. My kids were on spring break this week, so we went to a place. It's called Candyland, but it's not really like candy is not the focus. It's like a kids play place.
Mm-hmm. That's fun.
So like it's like a step down in age from like your, you know, ninja gym, your, you know, like a trampoline gym sort of area. Because we've been to one of those with the kids and like our older child loved it, but our younger child was too small to do some of the stuff. And like, it, you know, it was too expensive to like try to make that work. But this place was tailored for smaller kids and they had a great time. There is a like a small ninja course there that my older kid just like absolutely went crazy for. If she can hang or climb on things, she will hang or climb on things. So it was great. They even had little like climbing walls that they harnessed the kids into and both kids like climbed all the way up and it was awesome. And now we are snowed in with about 1.5 feet of snow, maybe more. And yeah, mere days away from spring, really living that winter life, you know? So
I'm sorry.
That's how it is out here.
You said snowed in March. And I thought Colorado and my mind immediately went to The Shining. So, you know,
that's fair. The number of deranged supernatural homicides does spike every time there's a snowstorm.
Yeah. Well, especially
just
in
across
March.
The state.
March snow is hard because you're like sort of over it.
On Monday,
snow, great. March snow, terrible.
Yeah. On Monday, I was wearing shorts.
Yeah. Every time we get a cold day around here, my daughter says, I've had a good amount of winter already.
That's a very positive way to put it. Like, I am satisfied. Don't overdo it.
Yeah.
From
shorts to snowed in.
Ugh. But that's, I know a lot of people in a lot of places are like, ho, 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 the weather here is always crazy and unpredictable. But it's like, having lived in other places where people say that, I'm like, no, you just don't pay attention.
Yeah.
When you're right next to giant mountains, the weather can be unpredictable.
Yeah.
And a bit like crazy. So yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's where we are. And that's how we're doing. Let's talk about some Jeopardy. We had some bangers this week.
Yeah, we did.
On Monday, March 11th, we had the last semifinal game of the Tournament of Champions, and that featured the contestants Brian Henniger, a guest services agent from La Follette, Tennessee, Troy Meyer, a music executive from Tampa, Florida, and Luigi De Guzman, an attorney from Arlington, Virginia. And the Jeopardy round categories are Renaissance Women, Down in the Valley, On Wheels, Resistance is Futile, Dealing with TV Reality, and Enigmatic Anagrams.
Mm-hmm. I thought that the level of the semifinals material was really high, and that then when we went into the final rounds, I thought some of the games got a little bit easier, which made sense to me in terms of, I think, a Tournament of Champions champion should have both an exceptional knowledge base and buzzer skills.
I agree. And I've also noticed that. I mean, I first pointed it out, of course, from my Tournament of Champions, because mm-hmm. I lost in the semifinals, having been in two what I consider extremely hard games.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, we still have a Facebook Messenger chat group with all of our TOC people. Mm-hmm. And just yesterday, it was brought back up, the question about Dinosaur Ridge being in what state, and they showed a map with, like, the corner.
With the other states labeled.
With Wyoming and Utah, and then it zooms out to show the entire shape of the state, and then it highlights the state in red, and it's a $1,600 clue in the finals.
And Kyle launched himself into the sun.
Well, that's, and Stephen Grade in the chat was like, one of my most vivid memories is Kyle slamming his fist down on the chair when this clue came on the board. I was like, yeah. Because mm-hmm. it was like, it started out Dinosaur Ridge, and I was like, ooh, I know this. This is exciting. This is specialized knowledge. And then it kept getting more and more, like, general until it was like, name one of the 50 states that's square, and we'll show it to you. Like
a quiz bowl question.
Right. Except you can't ring in.
It would be a fine quiz bowl question if you couldn't read ahead.
Yeah.
You could ring in when you knew the answer, right? I like that about the format of quiz bowl questions.
Right.
But
it was so yes, I agree. Especially noticed it in mine. I seem to recall having that same feeling with the last Tournament of Champions. And I agree on this one too.
Mm-hmm.
I was feeling more successful with the finals boards than with the semifinals boards this week.
Yeah.
Anyway, glad I could bring that up right off the bat.
Yeah. In On Wheels, I think it was. Yes, at the $1,000 mm-hmm. level. Oh, it was the very first clue of the round. Made without brakes, track bicycles are designed for this type of building. And here they are going around inside one. There was a picture. Brian got that. That's a velodrome. And that reminded me of another trivia endeavor, which they haven't asked me to plug them, but I did it. I enjoyed it. The Inkling, if you want to look it up. It's Kit Sikelski's trivia.
Oh, yeah.
Baby. It's like a paper booklet and a paper answer sheet that gets mailed to you. It's honor system. You fill out your answer sheet and send it back. There was some fun, artsy little swag that came with it. It's just for fun. And for, you know, bragging rights, there's no big cash prize and your money just funds writing and making the thing. But I tried mm-hmm. it for the first time last week and I had a great time. And it's 140 questions. And so I forgot to look up all of them after dropping my responses in the mail. But I took a guess that a velodrome was for bicycles. And so I was glad to see that come back up and to have my guess confirmed.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. Enigmatic Anagrams, I thought was going to be very challenging anagrams, and I found them challenging, but they were anagrams about mysterious things. Mm-hmm.
The anagram themselves were not enigmatic. They were just anagrams, but the correct responses had to do with enigmas. Right?
Yes. So at the $400 level, it's deceptive, bust, refuge. Troy got that. It's subterfuge. Nobody got the $1,000 level, adjective for specialized knowledge. So recite. I figured it out and I felt good because then it was a triple stumper. That's esoteric.
very on the nose.
Yeah. Oh, I liked Brian's incorrect guess on dealing with TV reality. From 2012 to 2020, Dave Navarro hosted this series that had episodes like Drill Baby Drill. And I thought to myself, I don't know whether that's about like the oil business or dentistry, but it's one of those. And Brian went with what is black gold, and that was incorrect. And it turns out it's Ink Master, and this was tattooing. I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Swing and a miss. I did really bad in that in that category.
Mm-hmm. I also struggled with the TV reality category. It was smart of all the contestants not to take a swing at the $600 level. Jennifer Lawrence said she'd give her Oscar to Heather Gay, Monica Garcia, and the Real Housewives of Here for that season finale in 24. And if you don't know, there are just too many titles in this franchise to, you know, take a guess and hope for the best. This one's the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Yeah. Daily Double number one is in Down in the Valley. It's at the $600 level, pick number 7. Luigi finds it. He's at $2,600. Brian's at $200. Troy's at zero at this point. Luigi makes it a true Daily Double, and he gets the clue. You'll find this Scots word for a valley before Eagles, Moore, and Co., among many others. And he gets it correct. It's a glen. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Luigi's up at 10,600 with a huge lead. Troy's at 2,400. Brian's at 1,000. And the Double Jeopardy categories are The Civil War, Behind the Music, Nature, It's Curtains, World of Lit, and AI in quotation marks. It's not artificial intelligence. They're just going to have that letter sequence in each correct response. Troy's knowledge base is intimidating.
It is, which we'll talk about later in the week. I will specifically talk about later in the week. I already know what I'm going to say.
Cool.
Yeah. The Jeopardy round was a lot of Luigi. Like, I mean, we just heard the scores, right? Luigi was in a pretty strong lead, but that pretty quickly changes. Luigi still does well. Like everyone, you know, presents themselves well, but Troy shows off why Double Jeopardy is so important in this game. But yeah, it's pretty crazy. I will say, the very first pick of the round, he is a music executive.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it was necessarily Brian's best choice to go to the music category
right away. I think that was an error, although I was impressed that the other contestants held their own in the music categories, I think, throughout the week, as much as they did against Troy.
Anyway, yeah, the $1,000 clue was the Beatles were just one of many artists with whom this legendary English producer crafted hit after hit. Brian guessed who's Brian Epstein, who is a well-known producer, so that's fine. But this was George Martin. I knew that. I have taught that many times. Yes.
Good job.
Talked about George Martin. He is the one who is responsible for the string quartet in the background of Yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a classically trained musician, and so he orchestrated all of that.
The way that Troy just rattled off obscure literary titles, and some of these are things I just haven't heard of. Some of them are deep in the recesses of my brain. He just had them, right? The $1,600 level of World of Lit in Hermann Hesse's futuristic final novel. Joseph Knecht has long been consumed with mastering this title competition. That's the glass bead game. I know the name Hermann Hesse. I have never heard of that one. That's kind of second tier Hesse, right?
Right. I mean,
Siddhartha. Steppenwolf is Hesse, right?
Like Steppenwolf. Yeah, those are the two that I feel pretty good about getting two titles for really any given author.
Yeah.
It's like, nope, go for this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the $2,000 level, the short story collection Face to Face was the first book by this South African woman who won a 1991 Nobel Prize. That's Nadine Gordimer. I'm sure I've seen her name, but I did not remember that at all. And then also, It's Curtains, her first short story collection, A Curtain of Green, contains her most famous story, Why I Live at the P.O. That's Eudora Welty. Troy got that one as well. These are really high-level clues. This is not common trivia fodder. These are deeper cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Luigi who talked about doing flashcards on the treadmill? I thought that was so fun.
I think so, yeah.
I think it was Luigi.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciated that. People don't think about the physical aspects of Jeopardy, but like I remember stepping off the stage after my one game and like my back was dying. Like I was just standing there, but it's like it's tense and like you're aware of being on TV. Like
right. Yeah. It's not nothing.
Yeah.
Daily Double number 2 is in the Civil War at the $800 level, pick number 7. Troy finds it, and this is where things take a turn. He's at 6,800, Luigi's at 12,200, and Brian is at 2,600. He bets it all. It's the right move. Gets the clue. Mm-hmm. When the war started, this future general was helping drill a volunteer company in Galena, Illinois. And he gets it correct with who is Grant.
That's right. And Daily Double number 3 is in AI at the $2,000 level. And Troy finds this one also. At this point, he's at 25,600 with Luigi at 18,200, Brian at 4,600. I thought Troy might go really big here, but he stuck with just 2,000. He has a choice between potentially locking it up, but risking his first place position, or keeping it smaller. He goes with keeping it smaller here. Think, fine choice. And he gets the clue. A contemporary of Buddha, Mahavira is revered as a leader and organizer of this religion. And he gets it correct. It's Jainism.
Jainism. Mm-hmm. Yes. Not one that you necessarily remember all the time.
Yeah.
So going into Final Jeopardy, Luigi is at 18,600. That's a really good score. Troy mm-hmm. is at 28,400. Brian is at 6,200. Good scoring game. Final Jeopardy category is word origins, and the clue is a radical in an 1833 failed uprising in Germany. Ludwig von Rochow coined this term for acts taken for practical reasons, not ethics. This is a triple stumper. Brian wrote, "What is I love you, Mom, Dad, Katie, Danny, and Dave, Gigi." That is not the term that the German guy used, so that is incorrect. And he wagered all but $5, so he drops to 5. Luigi also got it incorrect. He wrote, "What is pragmatism?" Mm-hmm. Which we know pragmatism from a different
deep dive. Right.
That is incorrect.
James. William James.
Yes.
William James.
Yes.
Not Henry. Not Henry James.
No. Different yeah. James. Mm-hmm. Other James. And that is incorrect. And Luigi wagered everything but $1. Mm-hmm.
This is a crushed game. So Luigi has to get it right. And Troy has to get it wrong for Luigi to have a chance of winning. If you care a lot about second versus first place, then, you know, sure, go smaller. But if Troy knows how to wager, which he does, Luigi has to get it right and Troy has to get it wrong for Luigi to have a chance of advancing. So he might as well go big.
Right. And Troy also wrote, "What is pragmatic?" which is incorrect. He made a cover bet of 8,801 and drops to 19,599, which means that Troy moves on to the finals. The correct answer is realpolitik.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a term I have seen a couple times, and now I guess I know what it means.
Yeah. And before we go on to the finals, there was some Jeopardy news that we wanted to circle back to, which is that Jeopardy has announced the Jeopardy Invitational Tournament.
Yes.
We've got good news and bad news. We're so excited about this tournament. We're so happy for Sam Kavanaugh.
Yes, finally, Sam Kavanaugh. Getting him in there.
Yes. Thrilled for Sam. Thrilled.
Yeah. We don't need to go through all the names, but there are some names that are good to see back, right?
Yeah.
Like a number of people who were in the All-Star games from our season.
Yep.
Sam Kavanaugh, of course, who got completely ignored with the changeover in leadership at Jeopardy.
Yep. Drew Garf. So glad to see him back.
Yeah. My boy Drew.
Yeah.
My boy Drew. I'm so proud of my boy.
Yeah, this is great.
A couple notable names missing off the list, though.
Yes.
Namely, Emily Brown and Kyle Jones.
Yeah, I mean, I have won 0 games of Jeopardy, and everyone here has won at least one game of Jeopardy. I'm not sure what the lowest count is, but it is many times. Many times my 0. Really showing off my intellect here. Yeah. I can see that there were some standards applied. They were not, you know, consistent quantitative standards, but I see that there was a criterion of somebody who won some games and was memorable or notable in some way. And I do not meet that first criterion. I would love for there to be a tournament field that's made up of people who've made Jeopardy their whole personality. Regardless of how they actually did on stage, but that's not what this is.
But yeah, so this tournament is coming up, and it does appear to be kind of the farm system for Jeopardy Masters, because the winner of this will move up into Jeopardy Masters after last time. I don't know, Jeopardy Masters, the bottom two players got quote unquote relegated, like the bottom two finishers.
Yeah.
So now, you know, moving forward, there's going to be, it appears, at least it seems like the plan will be, there will be this invitational tournament to get those people moving up into Jeopardy Masters for every time they're going to have Masters. Mm-hmm. So it should be good. It's already taped, obviously, at this point, because it's going to be coming up right after the Tournament of Champions. Yeah. So,
yep. Brad Rutter is another notable name missing from this list. I've encountered some.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly how the Jeopardy Masters format works, but there's some speculation that he's already in the Jeopardy Masters field and therefore he is not competing for a spot. I guess we'll see, you know.
It could be. I could see that because it said that two players were relegated, but only the winner of the tournament is going to be moving on.
Yeah. So, that would account for a major, major Jeopardy success story not being in this field.
Right.
I would love to see Kyle Jones here, Tournament of Champions semifinalist.
You know, I would love to see that too.
Yeah.
And
7-game winner.
Yeah. I mean, I realize
noted
I'm not going to. Noted podcast host.
Admired by dozens.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love that too. Maybe next time.
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Yeah. I will continue to hold out hope. It is so heartening to see that we're kind of bridging back into previous leadership teams to pull notable contestants.
Yes, this is the first time that we've seen that, right?
Yeah.
In the Michael Davies era.
Yeah.
This is really the first time that we have seen, other than really just James Holzhauer, this is the first time that we have seen contestants coming back from before season 36 or 37 or whatever. So that is encouraging. That is nice to see.
Absolutely. Anyway, let's go on into the finals. And this is not a 2-day total point affair. It's a best of
seven. No, it is not. It's a best of seven. It's the Masters GOAT format.
I like the best of seven.
I like best of seven, too. It allows for, how to word this, it allows for the average to come out more often.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I agree with that. There's less likely to be a win due to fluctuations, volatility, the vicissitudes.
Right. The vicissitudes.
The vicissitudes of the board.
Yeah.
All right. So it is our first of question mark. We'll see how many games of the Tournament of Champions finals. We could wrap this thing up in three games. Spoiler, we don't. We're playing until somebody has three wins. The contestants, of course, are Ben Chan, a philosophy professor from Green Bay, Wisconsin, Troy Meyer, a music executive from Tampa, Florida, and Yogesh Raut, a social and personality psychologist from Vancouver, Washington. With the Jeopardy round categories from the newspapers, investing and business terms, one-word Beatles song titles, soups on, idioms and expressions, and literary title adjectives.
These players are so fast.
They're so fast. A lot of this I knew, but I just couldn't think of it before they rang in and got it right.
Yeah. And there were a few incorrect responses, which I like to see. It means they're going for it. It means they're playing, right? They're not playing scared. And there were a couple of triple stumpers. For instance, the $800 level of idioms and expressions. This expression, meaning you have to suffer to advance, was used in the 17th century in plural form by Robert Herrick. Apparently, no pains, no gains, which leads me to wonder, was this guy like
a
all
gym
about
bro?
The gym bro? Get those sick gains.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my first response also. The $800 level of literary title adjectives gave me a flashback. A Tony winner by Larry Kramer, the blank heart. Troy got that. That's the normal heart. And you all know I'm based in the New York area and used to be a minister at a church in Manhattan where when that was, I guess, on Broadway, maybe. No, it was when the TV version was coming out. There was somebody in my congregation who knew either Larry Kramer himself or somebody closely involved with that production. And we had these like slips where people could submit their prayer requests and we were supposed to work them into the prayer. And like every single week, this man who is so dear to me would submit like a paragraph of prayer for the success in like ratings and critical acclaim of the normal heart. And like, you know, by all means, pray for what you want. But I'm like, this is going to be so weird to read out loud. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I figured out how to do it. But I saw the normal heart come up and I was like, oh, I've had to figure out how to pray for that. dozens of times. My job is so weird.
Yeah.
Ben was a little looser and having more fun, I thought.
He did seem to be that way, which is cool. It's good to see. Yeah. It's good to be like, yeah, man, you made it to the finals and you can't. Here's the thing. If you lose this one, you're not out.
Yep. Got to play at least two more times after this.
Yeah. Take a load off, man.
Yeah.
Daily double number one is at the bottom of from the newspapers, $1,000 level at pick number four. And Troy uncovers it. He is already off to a good start. He's at 1600. Yogesh is at zero and Ben is at 600. He bets it all and gets the clue. In 1921, Italian radicals make issue of this pair's case. And wouldn't you know it, this was in a quiz I recently gave. We just talked about them. That's Sacco and Vanzetti. And of course, Troy knew that one.
Of course he did.
Of course he did. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Yogesh is at 3,600, Troy is at 5,800, and Ben is at 6,000. Double Jeopardy categories are plain geography, prose and Congress, I like that, unmanned space exploration, the nightly news, K-N-I-G-H-T, who's the biopic subject, or as Yogesh insisted on saying, biopic, and starts with P, P in quotation marks.
Was this one the perfect round? They had a perfect round sometime.
It is not, no.
Okay, cool. I thought the nightly news was a fun category. We had the $400, this holy object has been sought by knights in ancient legend and much more recently by Graham Chapman. That is the Holy Grail. Troy got that one. Ben got one about the Las Vegas Golden Knights. Ben got one about the equestrian knight is the longtime logo of this British brand known for its trench coats. That's Burberry. We had a weird ruling at the $1,200 level. This colorful poem dates to the 14th century and includes the main character being tempted by a lord's wife. Yogesh rang in and said, what is Gawain and the Green Knight? Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And he was ruled incorrect because Ken was ruling on the first one. Then Troy got in with Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. But later they awarded Yogesh points also because he had started to correct himself before being ruled incorrect, and that was adequate. I took a really weird English literature course at a local state college when I was in high school with this like weird kind of creepy old professor, and one of the assignments was rewriting the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in a completely different poetic meter. I can't remember what we were supposed to like, but we'd studied that poem and then we'd studied, I don't know, ballad meter or something, I don't know, and had to rewrite the whole thing using like techniques typical of the era, which is way too hard of an assignment for, I think, for an intro level course at what is essentially a glorified community college. But I did work in like an excellent final couplet with a double entendre around verb to cleave and cleavage, because there's like a temptation of a beautiful lady. I thought I was very pleased with myself.
It does feel nice to, I don't know,
just really hit the assignment out of the park, you know, do so much more.
As always.
Daily double number two is in prose and Congress at the $1,600 level, pick number 10. Troy finds it. He's at 9,000 with Yogesh at 9,600 and Ben at 9,200. This is where Troy really takes off. He makes it a true daily double and he gets the clue. In 2011, this senator published The Speech, a historic filibuster on corporate greed and the decline of our middle class. And he gets it correct. It's Bernie Sanders.
Which I wondered if it was that obvious.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember that particular, you know, speech or whatever, but I was like, well, it sounds like Bernie Sanders.
It sounds like Bernie Sanders. Yeah.
And daily double number three is and starts with P at the $2,000 level, pick number 19. Troy also finds this one. He's at 24,800. Yogesh is at 11,600. Ben's at 10,000. And he wagers 6,000, trying to, you know, put it out of reach. Gets the clue. Part of this word for a long rambling journey nearly spells out a type of falcon. And I thought that was weirdly worded. But Troy tried what is a peregrine, which makes sense. But the word they're looking for is peregrination.
Right.
Which, yes, peregrine has an E after the end and peregrination does not do that. But to me, it would feel like it should be shorter than peregrine. You know what I mean? I see, yeah. Like that wording made me think like it just doesn't get all the way. It has
word.
Part of it.
Part of this word. Yeah, no, it's
yeah, I guess. Yeah. I guess. Yeah, all right. All right.
Like I
whatever.
See it.
I was just
parsing the amount of time provided.
So Troy drops back. Makes the game much closer.
Yeah. So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Yogesh is at 15,600, Troy at 22,000, Ben at 10,000. And the final Jeopardy category is World Theater. I always make the mistake when we have a world literature category of thinking that we're not going to be in the United States or Canada or Europe, right? That they're mm-hmm. trying to point us away from Eurocentrism, away from Eurocentrism,
yeah.
right? And Anglo,
yeah.
like English yeah. and Europe. The clue here is this 1867 play has a reindeer hunt and a king dwelling in snowy mountains, but its title character also spends time in Morocco and Egypt. Ben comes up with the correct response with what is Peer Gynt and a $5,601 wager. He is $1 ahead of Yogesh now. Yogesh correctly responds, what Peer Gynt? I, for one, welcome our new Troy overlord. yeah.
I believe this was the game where in the interview, Yogesh talked about putting together a trivia contest between himself, Victoria Gross, and Troy.
Yeah.
And that Troy won.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I didn't know Troy's name before that, but hearing that, I'm like, oh, Troy's like a fixture.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah. So Yogesh stays at 15,600, which means that Ben is in the lead. And Troy went for the right playwright, Henrik Ibsen, but the wrong play. He guesses what is Hedda Gabler. And with a 9201 cover bet, he drops down to 12,799, which means that Ben has the win. And so Ben gets that first point and he's taken the early lead, so he can rest yeah. easy.
Yes, he can.
Yep.
So Wednesday, we get the second game of the finals. Same contestants. Jeopardy round categories are World Capital Attractions, Virtuo So Good, Bitting at the Champs.
Troy kept pronouncing it biting, which sure, I don't care.
Because that's the term.
Pun.
Anyway,
yeah.
B-I-T in quotation marks.
Well,
the clock in the calendar.
The bit, right?
Right.
Champing at the bit.
I guess. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird one to try to make your brain fit around.
Yeah.
And honestly, you shouldn't spend brain power on category
right.
names when mm-hmm. you're trying to think of correct responses. The clock in the calendar, real names of unreal people. Yeah, smash that subscribe button. Love it. I finally remembered at the $800 level that Anna Wintour is associated with Vogue.
Yes.
Because that's a name that I've heard about 8 billion times
mm-hmm.
and never remember.
Ah,
so I felt good about it.
Good job. And of course, the boss in The Devil Wears Prada and the publication there are very obviously Anna Wintour and Vogue. We've talked about the $1,000 level of Virtuoso Good before. This composer and violin mm-hmm. virtuoso revolutionized playing technique, including new methods of fingering and tuning. They had a picture and sound. So fancy. And Troy got that. That's Paganini.
That is Paganini. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Composer and violin virtuoso is pretty much always going to be Paganini
mm-hmm.
in trivia. There are others, but the one you will be expected to know is Paganini.
Yep. Also a fun clue at the $1,000 level of bidding at the champs. Grossly excessive, like tuition at the Ken Jennings School of Necromancy and Horticulture. Ben got in with what is exorbitant. Ben always made sure to emphasize those bits in the bidding mm-hmm. at the champs category, and then Ken quipped that, you know, they have very high costs at the Ken Jennings School of Necromancy and Horticulture.
I think I'd want to attend that, though. Although, I don't know. Necromancy is weird.
Yeah.
Don't want to get into that.
Yeah, you know, fair enough.
Easy to go evil, I think, down that route.
Uh-huh.
Interesting triple stumper at the $400 level of clock and calendar. Months on the Islamic calendar traditionally begin when this type of moon is sighted in the western sky. Troy guessed what's a full moon, which, you know, makes sense. It's a common one. Ben guessed what's a new moon, which I guess also kind of makes sense, but I think they were ignoring the Islamic part.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crescent moon,
right,
which is one of the symbols of Islam.
Daily Double yeah, yeah. number one is in World Capital Attractions at the $1,000 level. It's pick number 4. Troy finds it. He's at 1,400. Yogesh is at 0. Ben is at 1,000. Troy makes it a true Daily Double, and he gets the clue Museo Botero and Plaza de Bolivar. And he gets that correct with what is Bogota. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the Jeopardy round, we're pretty close. Yogesh is at 4,800. Troy at 5,800. Ben's between them at 5,600. The double Jeopardy categories are H is for history, official state stuff, 17th century writing, sky and sea, singers, and diacritical thinking. They all were just kind of having fun with it in these games. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe the tension will rise as we head toward a third win, but
right.
It seemed like there was a lot of fun. In diacritical thinking, I noticed in Hawaiian, this single open quote mark called the okina is a this stop, a sound made by opening and closing a certain body part. And Yogesh, I think, tried to say glottal stop with like a glottal stop in place of the T. There was like a lot of playfulness happening among all the contestants, which is fun.
Yeah, because it is fun. Yeah, it's a fun game. Like, I understand when things are going bad and people get frustrated because like they want to do well. Like, I get that. But it's a fun game. Hopefully when, you know, anybody who gets on the stage can have enough success to just be like, you know, this is a fun game.
Yeah, it's a fun game. That's why we're there.
I wonder if the Jeopardy writers think that people just don't know things about the Western states.
I do not
like official states. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, with kind of the overwhelming dominance that like New York City seems to have in trivia, the big cities, New York, Chicago, Washington, Boston.
Yeah.
Right. Even Los Angeles, which is a huge major city, doesn't seem to have the same place in trivia as those more eastern cities.
Yeah.
And so like the $2,000 level of state stuff is, it's just, what's the state flower of Colorado, right? From Boulder to Pueblo, Colorado residents celebrate this as their state flower. And they showed a picture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a $2,000 clue in the finals. Mm-hmm. Like, I know I'm from Colorado, so I know it's the Columbine.
But I also knew it was the Columbine.
Yeah, especially because Columbine is a word that everyone who was born before like 1995 knows, right?
Right.
Like, we know that word, and probably you know that it is a flower.
Right.
So I thought that, I don't know, The Western state questions to me are always like extremely surface level, but maybe I'm just too in it.
Yep.
Maybe I'm like that XKCD comic about experts never having a good read on what people know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Daily Double number 2 is in 17th century writing at the $1,200 level. Yogesh uncovers it. He is at 9,200. Troy's at 11,000. Ben's at 7,200. And he bets it all. Gets the clue. In his 1624 history of Virginia and New England, he included the famous story of his rescue. And Yogesh gets it correct with who is John Smith, which Yogesh makes a joke about taking a random guess with a generic name, but it is in fact John Smith.
That's funny. I forgot that John Smith was the most generic, quite generic as far as first and last names go.
Yes.
And Daily Double number 3 is an official state stuff. It's at the $800 level. Troy finds this one. He's at 21,800, a bit of a lead over Yogesh, who's at 18,400. Ben is at 9,200. This is pick number 19. Troy decides to make it a true daily double. Huge gutsy move. Huge, huge move. Not a bad move. This is at the $800 level of official state stuff. It's been a pretty easy category. It's squarely in Troy's knowledge base. I think his choice here is, do I make an attempt to win the game now? Or do I wait to see what Final Jeopardy is?
Yeah.
And if he blows it, he's going to get at least one more game to try again. So this is apparently the third largest daily double wager ever. Or maybe it's the third largest true daily double ever. I don't remember exactly what the statistic was that Ken said. And the other two were both James Holzhauer bets. I thought that Roger Craig's was bigger, but then I went and looked it up. Roger Craig was noted for consecutive true daily doubles that took him from 9,000 to 18,000 to 36,000. So this is bigger than that.
Yeah.
He gets the clue. Arizona's state fossil is this tree product. Arizona is also home to a forest full of it. And he gets it correct. It is petrified wood. And that takes him up into the stratosphere.
Yeah. So going into Final Jeopardy, Yogesh is at 20,400. That's a great score. But Troy's at 46,800. And Ben's at 10,400, which is also a great score. Final Jeopardy category is books of the Bible. The clue is, this book is named for a tribe of Israel that carried out judgment of the idolaters of the golden calf. And they all get it correct. You gotta, you gotta go back. There are only a few options. They all get it correct with what is Leviticus. Ben wagered nothing. Yogesh bet it all. Troy wagered nothing. Didn't matter because Troy had the lock. So he wins game number 2. well, his game number one, but the second game of the finals.
That's right. So that brings us to Thursday, where we've got the same three contestants, of course. Troy and Ben both have 1 point on the board. Yogesh is looking for his first win. The Jeopardy round categories are Look at the Map, Health and Medicine, Con You Dig It, Festivals, Songs of Youth, and Crossword Clues Are. Songs of Youth was songs that mentioned being young, not necessarily what the young people currently are listening to or whatever.
Yeah. Although we had a fun one at the $400 level, inspired by her bestie, Tay-Tay, saying, when somebody tells you they love you at this title age, you're going to believe them. Troy guessed what's 17, Yogesh guessed what is 22, and then remembered it after he was ruled incorrect. That's 15. And Troy made a joke about them, that they're going to get killed for that.
Yeah.
The Look at the Map category was the one that brought up the trauma of the, like, name Colorado clue from my tournament, the $400 level. This Mediterranean capital has endured for more than two millennia, and they show a map and they highlight the city, mm-hmm. and they also put mm-hmm. Algeria underneath it. And Yogesh rang in and he seemed hesitant to be like, are they just giving me Algiers? And he said, what's Algiers? And that's correct, because it's like, it shouldn't be that easy.
Right. I sort of felt like the whole Look at the Map category was kind of, it shouldn't be that easy. Like, it was almost
just a buzzer speed test.
Yeah. Or like a dumb questions kind mm-hmm. of category. Stupid answers. That's what they call that one. They all had images. They all felt pretty obvious.
Daily Double number one is in Con You Dig It at the $1,000 level, pick number 15. Troy finds it. He's at 2,600. Yogesh is at 3,200. Ben's at 4,600. He bets it all. Gets the clue. The Aga Khans hold this title as leaders of the Shiite Nizari Ismaili sect. And I knew I had a coin flip in my head. I was like, I don't know this, but there are two terms that I can think of. And I think he did the same thing. And he ended up going with what is caliph?
Mm-hmm.
But they are imams.
Yeah.
I feel like caliph is almost more of a political title, isn't it?
I think so. It is associated with Shia Islam, mm-hmm. but I think there's generally like one caliph.
That's...
Yeah. I could be mistaken, though.
So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Yogesh is at 4,600. Troy is up to 2,800, and Ben is in the lead at 5,800. Double Jeopardy categories are ancient history, books by reporters, memorials and monuments. It's a fact, which I hope all of these are.
Mm-hmm.
The name on the Oscar, and ends in IX.
This was a perfect round.
Yes, every clue responded to correctly. There was at least one incorrect response.
Right. I see a rebound at the $1,600 level of It's a Fact.
Mm-hmm. And I think that might be it.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Very.
Yeah, these players know what they're doing. And really, that one was just trying to think too quickly, I think. The clue was, in the U.S., a quadrillion has this many zeros. Yogesh got in first and guessed what is 12. Troy got the rebound. It's 15.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't go like far enough with the term.
The name on the Oscar at the $800 level. Best Picture 2019 starring Song Kang-ho and Cho Yo-jung. Ben got in, and that's Parasite. I was frozen up trying to remember the name of the director of Parasite, but for Best Picture, it's just the film title.
Just the film title.
Yeah.
Yeah. The $2,000 level of It's a Fact, I was surprised at the ruling. The clue is, stepping down in 2024 after 52 years on the throne, she had the longest reign of any Danish monarch. And Ben rang in and said, who's Marguerite? And Ken said, yes, Marguerite II.
Yep, that seems like an error to me.
I was like, but Marguerite II is like, if you were asking for an English queen and I said Elizabeth and left it at that, I would at least get, can you be more specific?
Right.
And if not, then it would be like, no, that's incorrect, because that just the name implies the first, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm with you. I think given that Ken didn't prompt for specificity, it would seem unfair to me to reverse the ruling, I think.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's not wrong. It's like, yeah, he didn't say Marguerite the First.
Yeah.
So it's just incomplete.
Right. But yeah, I don't think Ken should have supplied it. I think Ben should have needed to supply it.
Yeah.
Daily Double number two is in Memorials and Monuments. It's at the $1,600 level, pick number 9. Troy finds this one. He's at 5,600 with Yogesh at 5,000 and Ben at 13,000. Troy makes it a true Daily Double and he gets the clue, dedicated to the memory of great Frenchmen. It's the final resting place of women too, including Marie Curie and Simone Veil. And he gets it correct. It's the Pantheon.
Yes. Oh, man, I had a hard time trying to remember what I was like. Oh, I know this. I just read about it. something something. And daily double number three is an Enzen IX at the $1,200 level, and Yogesh finds this one. He's at 12,200, Choi's at 13,200, Ben's at 17,800, and he bets it all. Lots of big bets flying around here. Gets the clue. This town at the foot of Mont Blanc hosted the first Winter Olympics in 1924. And he gets it correct. He says Chamonix or Chamonix.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct.
Yeah. And I think strategic to give both pronunciations, given that it's an ends in IX. You know, if you're pretty sure that it's pronounced Chamonix, but not 100%, you may want to like pronounce that IX phonetically to make sure you get credit. So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, we find Yogesh in the lead this time with 29,600, Troy's at 15,200, Ben's at 17,800. And the final Jeopardy category is the United Nations, with the clue, of the nine countries that have produced a UN Secretary General, this nation is the only one from its hemisphere. They all get this one. They've studied their UN Secretaries General, which is something we keep meaning to do around here.
It's on our list, yep.
Man. So we come to Troy first. He has, what is Peru? Javier Perez de Cuellar was from Peru, and he's the only UN Secretary General from a Southern Hemisphere country. Gotta think Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, Eastern Hemisphere, Western Hemisphere to kind of figure out like which hemisphere are we talking about here. Yeah. He's wagered 15,200 everything, puts him up to 30,400. Ben also got it correct with what is Peru and a $12,601 wager, which puts him at 30,401 to get ahead of Troy's double up. And Yogesh also gets it with a $6,001 cover bet, which puts him at 35,601. You know, he was watching for Ben to do an all-in and make sure he would win even in that circumstance. And so he's got a point on the board. Each of them has one, which means we're going on to at least five games in this potentially seven-game series.
That is right. Love it. And then we get to Friday, game four of the finals. It's all tied at one apiece. The Jeopardy categories are That's So 18th Century, Types of Poems, Food and Drink, On the Web, TV Drama, and Champ Change, which is clues about winning, sort of, that you have to change a word to another word.
Yeah.
For the $800 clue, I don't know, the writers, again, I'm loving how off the rail some of the writing has been, but a championship flag trades one of its ends for a D and becomes this dangling thing.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
That's not what I meant. I just meant that is not the precise kind of writing that we normally get from a Jeopardy.
Okay.
This dangling thing. Also,
with a D.
That's still not what I meant. It's not a Nick. Emily, a championship flag is not a Nick.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, they're looking for, so the championship flag is a pennant, and they change one of the D's and becomes a pendant. That's fine. For the record, that's not what I thought. I was just saying that a Jeopardy clue, when they don't provide a picture, just saying this dangling thing is like, what?
Wow. I'll get my mind out of the gutter.
Wow, Reverend.
I think the writers are to blame here.
That's fair. Yeah. It's all, totally changing gears. What's it called when there's a phrase that is like a redundant phrase, like when you call it an ATM machine or...
Oh, I can't remember.
I also can't remember. Anyway, I recently learned the whole point of that is to the $400 level of That's So 18th Century. The clue is this 12,000-foot volcano in Japan erupted in 1707, but thankfully has been dormant for the ensuing 300-plus years. Yogesh got it right with Fujiyama, and I recently learned that Yama, the suffix or whatever, means mountain. So if you call it Mount Fuji, that's fine, but if you call it Mount Fujiyama, you are being unnecessarily redundant.
I didn't know that.
I don't remember where I learned that.
Yeah.
But it was in the last week before this game came up.
We had a funny moment. They had a triple stumper on the very first clue. One of very few triple stumpers. Was it the only triple stumper in this round? Was there another one?
Might have been. I think that was the only triple stumper.
Yeah, it was the only triple stumper. So Clue number one was a triple stumper. There was a picture. And then with spinach as a star ingredient, the dish seen here goes by this two-word name, partly after a city. Ben tried, what is quiche Lorraine? That was incorrect. Nobody picked it up. It's quiche Florentine. And Yogesh immediately quips, there goes our perfect game.
That's a good one. After very first clue. That does remind me that I also just recently figured out which one was which between quiche Lorraine and quiche Florentine. Because they always seem to be paired, at least to me, because I guess because my main exposure to them is from the Costco mini quiche boxes.
Oh.
But like whenever you have like a variety of quiches, there's always quiche Lorraine and always quiche Florentine, right?
Right.
And they're always next to each other. But I have never known which is which until also very recently. I had a conversation where I was finally like, okay, which one has the spinach and which one has the bacon? And I remember it specifically because my mind assumed it was the other way around. Why? I have no idea. I have no clue why. Why I would think Lorraine must mean spinach and Florentine must mean bacon. I don't know. But
yeah,
now I know.
Yeah. Now I know. I don't know if people are struggling with that, but I feel like you could make a connection between a false connection, but it would help as a mnemonic between Florentine and like flora and fauna, right? Like flora.
It's a good flora. Right? That's a good, yes. Yes. Smart.
That's how I got on Jeopardy. Daily Double number one is in types of poems. I liked types of poems. That was fun.
It was fun.
It was at the $600 level, pick number 11. Ben found it. He was at negative 800 at this point, with Yogesh at 2600 and Troy at 3800. And he's in the red, so he can only wager up to 1,000, but he does wager 1,000, and he gets the clue. A villanelle is a 19-line poem consisting of 5 tercets and a concluding, do the math, one of these. And we saw him do a little, I don't know, finger math, trying to piece it together, and then he got it. It's a quatrain. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Yogesh is at 6,400, Troy's at 8,000, Ben's made it up at this point to 1,800, and the double Jeopardy categories are making a pass, Lost Works, What the H in quotation marks, Famous Women, Movie Songs, and Extinct Animals.
The Extinct Animals one made me really sad.
Yeah.
Just in general. Nothing specific, but, you know.
Just the idea of extinct animals.
Yeah. Particularly ones that have gone extinct much more recently, because it's like, at some point we should know better, right?
Yeah. You would think. Troy had talked about how his music executive job is like being everybody's dad to a bunch of musicians, which I can empathize with, because my job is like being everybody's mom to a bunch of septuagenarians and octogenarians. Anyway, I liked seeing him sort of squint at the board and then get it right at the $800 level of movie songs. Now I'm laughing to the bank. Wraps this man in Am I Dreaming over the end credits of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. The S's in Wraps and this are changed to dollar signs, which gave it to Troy. It's ASAP Rocky. They all sort of hesitated for a second on that one, I think, if I remember right. Lost Works also made me sad.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, but for me, yeah, the one about Scott Joplin losing a trunk worth of music scores that possibly contained a ragtime opera. That would have been cool to hear.
Yeah.
Also, I can't imagine how infuriating that must have been. So much work suddenly gone. With no cloud to back it up.
Yeah.
Wild.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Donner Party a thing that everyone knows, or is it more of a Western knowledge thing?
We know that. Yes. Okay. We know that in the East.
That's what I thought, because it's like, oh, you want a story about people eating people? Here you go.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wondered, because like, yeah, we know out here, we know the Donner Party and Donner Pass.
Yep.
Which... now you can just drive through. Like, you're just cruising along if you're heading to or from Nevada. Feels kind of weird. There's just a sign off on the side of the road. It's like, oh, we're going through Donner Pass. It's like, oh man, look at how comfortable I am in my heated vehicle.
I would feel weird about that.
I remember thinking about it as a kid, you know, having learned what that was. And then I'm like, oh, a bunch of people died here.
Yeah.
And possibly ate each other.
I guess part of the thing is you really can't go around, right? Like, I mean...
No, it's a pass. It's the easiest route.
Yeah.
Although I think I've read that it is less likely that cannibalism was actually practiced.
Oh. But,
like, we're not actually sure. I don't know. Maybe that's just people being like, how can we really know? But I seem to recall reading something about how, like, the Donner Party did not resort to cannibalism necessarily.
Mm. Okay.
But they did definitely get snowed in and die. So,
yeah.
Anyway, on that note,
that's cheery. Yeah.
this whole board just made me sad. All right. Daily Double number 2 was at the $1,600 level of Lost Works. It's pick number 8. And Ben finds it. He's been trailing, but sort of keeping pace this whole time. He's at 5,000. Yogesh is at 9,600. And Troy is at 13,200. He bets it all because he kind of needs to. Gets the clue. In the lost ancient epic Aethiopis, the Ethiopian king Memnon fights for Troy and is killed by this Greek hero. And Ben gets it correct with who is Achilles, which I don't know if he knows that work, but that's a good guess.
Mm-hmm. And Troy is the one who finds Daily Double number 3, pick number 15. It's at the $800 level of Making a Pass. At this point, he's at 14,000 with Yogesh at 14,800 and Ben at 11,200. And Troy makes it a true Daily Double. It's gutsy.
Gutsy.
I think it's the right move, though. And he gets the clue. The first major U.S.-German battle of World War II took place in February 1943 at Kasserine Pass on this continent. It's the $800 level. But, like, also we're in the finals of the TOC. And, like, you can rule out Antarctica. And, like, if it were Europe, this wouldn't be the question.
Yeah.
You know it's not North America. So, like, you haven't got a lot of choices here, but he either knows it or he guesses it right. It's Africa.
Yeah. Yeah. The first engagements between the U.S. were, you know, in North Africa with against Rommel and his desert campaign.
Yeah.
Before, obviously, in 1943, before D-Day, because that was in 1944. Americans weren't involved really in earlier invasion attempts like Market Garden and things like that. So, yeah, there's really only one option because Americans did not fight Germans in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Australia, you know, or South America or anything like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. I guess the thing I thought was funny here was with basically zero history knowledge, if you just know the continents and I don't know, like how a Jeopardy question works and like live in the world,
right?
Like you can narrow it down.
Yeah. That was not a terribly tricky question.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that does get Troy out to a really big lead, but. Gosh, these scores. Going into Final Jeopardy, Yogesh is at 20,400. Troy is at 33,200. And Ben is at 12,800. So all of them are within reach of the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And we get the Final Jeopardy category of Historic Americans. And the clue is near Kirkbean on Solway Firth, U.S. Vice Admiral Gerald Wright presented a memorial plaque honoring this man. And they all guessed military men. Ben got it correct with who is John Paul Jones, of course, a famous ancestor of mine.
Yeah.
And he wagered everything. Apparently, JPJ was born in Scotland, and there's a museum there observing his birthplace. I did not know that. And so he doubles up to 25,600, which is an incredibly convenient amount to be able to double up with.
Mm-hmm.
Yogesh wrote Hu Farragut, which is another naval person in American history, but incorrect. He wagered 5,200, so he drops to 15,200. And Troy guessed who is Pershing, which, I mean, is obviously a military man, but he was not a naval person. I don't know, vice admiral kind of suggests naval person. And so that's also incorrect. He wagered 7,601, which was a cover bet to cover Yogesh's all-in. And it just so happens to be exactly $1 more, which allows Ben to win with 25,600. Like it's wild that the numbers worked out that way.
Yeah.
And so Ben, coming from behind in both games that he has won, is now leading with 2 match points.
Mm-hmm. It's so exciting.
I know. It could end on Monday. It could take 3 more games. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it takes 3 more games because these are very good games and I enjoy watching them.
Yeah.
Oof. Goodness. All right. So that's the week. And we'll wrap up the TOC next week. Man, good games. And this is the point in the episode where we remind you we have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/potentpotables. A number of you already support us there, and we appreciate each and every one of you who does. And if you feel like supporting us financially is something you could do, then you can go there and you can donate a certain amount a month to help us keep the podcast going, breaking even and all that. You can get some exclusive content there. Every day that passes pushes us farther and farther away from the exclusive content that we have made. But we also like to put our quiz questions in while editing is going on so that patrons can get a sneak preview of them. And then also have access to them later if they ever need, you know, trivia questions. There's a big, big bank of them there for you to draw on. So that's patreon.com/potentpotables. And of course, there are some things that are more important in our world. Not many, but there are some than our podcast. A handful. And we have some of those causes in the show notes that we think are important and worthwhile for you to check out if you'd rather send your money that way.
That's right.
All right. Emily,
yes.
As we have said numerous times, there were not a lot of triple stumpers this week. So it's what do you think we're going to be talking about?
Are we talking about Realpolitik?
We are talking about Realpolitik. The
awesome.
The missed final Jeopardy from Monday.
I was like, I'm getting the 10 points this week because really the only feasible options here, there are three of them, I think. Realpolitik, mm-hmm. Paradise Lost, and the Aga Khan's.
Yeah.
Maybe actually, you could come up with something about Undertow, but
it was hard. And,
yeah.
You know, I saw Realpolitik and I was like, you know, that's a term I've heard, but never knew before this Final Jeopardy, never knew what it meant. So I'd like to look into it and kind of learn a little bit more about it. And hopefully other people will, too. So that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to talk about. And honestly, I mean, this is probably going to be a pretty short deep dive because it's really just it's an idea. There are a number of examples throughout history, throughout the world, and then that's just kind of it. Like, it is a political ideal, I guess, that exists, and we can see throughout history and in the modern day. So it's really just more like an understanding of what that term means and kind of how it fits into our world currently.
Cool.
So, yeah, Realpolitik, which comes from the German for real, like realistic, practical, or actual, and politics. It's the approach of conducting diplomatic or political policies based primarily on considerations of given circumstances and factors, rather than strictly following ideological, moral, or ethical premises. So it shares a lot of its aspects with the philosophical approach of realism and pragmatism, and it's often simply referred to as pragmatism in politics, or when people refer to politicians as being, you know, pragmatic or realistic in their policies, that falls in line with Realpolitik. It can be used depending on who's saying it and what they're trying to mean by it. It can be a positive term. It can be a neutral term. It can also be a pejorative term, depending on how you're choosing to paint it. Because, you know, by a strict definition, it's just making decisions based on current circumstances, right? And how to most effectively reach a goal, which can be, you know, from certain perspectives, a very positive thing. Or if you're just looking at it from a cold, results-oriented viewpoint, it's a neutral thing. Or if you disagree with what they're trying to do, it can be a very negative thing.
Yeah.
So it's not a good or bad thing. It just is, depending on your view. It can often be perceived as coercive or amoral or even Machiavellian. There are a lot of names that have been proponents or examples of Realpolitik throughout history, including Otto von Bismarck, Henry Kissinger, as a couple of names that probably most people would recognize, Charles de Gaulle, Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader of the People's Republic of China after Mao Zedong. Other names that I didn't recognize, like George F. Kennan. Man, I will never pronounce this name right. Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Same.
I think.
Better you than me.
There are way too many Z's in that name.
Mm-hmm.
Hans Dietrich Genscher, and among other names, right? Lots of people throughout history have taken the approach of what is it we're trying to achieve? What is the most effective way to do it, regardless of whether the means are in line with a particular ideal, right, or ideology. So as the clue in the Final Jeopardy told us, it was coined by Ludwig von Rochow. He was a German journalist and politician. His name was actually August Ludwig von Rochow. He lived from 1810 to 1873. He was involved in the April 3rd, 1833 Frankfurter Wochensturm, which was a failed attempt to start a revolution in Germany. If you recall, we've talked about it a number of times on the podcast, but the mid-1800s were a time of many revolutions in Europe, or attempted revolutions. Mm-hmm. And so this particular failed revolution, a group of students attacked soldiers and policemen at the Frankfurt police offices to try to gain control over the treasury of the German Confederation and try to jumpstart a revolution in all German states. But the plot had been betrayed and they were easily stopped. Mm. However, a number of them, well, some of them fled to the United States. Others fled elsewhere, but some remained and kind of laid the groundwork for the 1848 revolutions, which actually led to the eventual unification of Germany as the German state that we now know it. Mm-hmm. So he was part of that initial movement. However, because of his political activity, he did spend much of his time in exile. In fact, he wrote his book, The Principles of Realpolitik, or his essay. Well, no, he wrote that while he was in Heidelberg in 1853, but he had lived in France in exile for quite a while until the failed French Revolution of 1848, which, if I recall, I think that's what Les Mis is based on. And then he returned to Germany and, yeah, continued his work. In 1869, he became a deputy of the North German Reichstag and was elected to the first German Reichstag in 1871 as a member of the National Liberal Party, which was a German liberal party from 1867 until 1918. So that's a little bit about the guy who came up with it, Ludwig von Rachow. And like I said, he kind of outlined it in that 1853 essay. His definition of the term is, "The study of the forces that shape, maintain, and alter the state is the basis of all political insight and leads to the understanding that the law of power governs the world of states just as the law of gravity governs the physical world. The older political science was fully aware of this truth, but drew a wrong and detrimental conclusion, the right of the more powerful. The modern era has corrected this unethical fallacy, but while breaking with the alleged right of the more powerful one, the modern era was too much inclined to overlook the real might of the more powerful and the inevitability of its political influence." So it's a very realistic view of things, saying the old monarchical power said that whoever is the most powerful deserves to rule. We know that's wrong, but also we shouldn't ignore the fact that powerful people exert influence and powerful entities do as well. He said that the great achievement of the Enlightenment had been to show that might is not necessarily right. The mistake liberals made was to assume that the law of the strong had suddenly evaporated simply because it had been shown to be unjust. He wrote that to bring down the walls of Jericho, the real politicker knows the simple pickaxe is more useful than the mightiest trumpet. His ideas were seized upon by many people, including, like I said, Otto von Bismarck, who was instrumental in the unification of Germany in the mid-19th century. It is a political practice, and it has been implemented in a number of different facets of politics, including like international relations. Often it's referred to as political realism in that case. It proceeds from the assumption that states and actors in the international arena pursue their interests by practicing realpolitik, which is basically just the idea that any state that functions internationally, their policy is going to be based on the pursuit, possession, and application of power. Political realism is a term that I have used in this and has been used throughout history to refer to things that are basically realpolitik or similar to realpolitik going way back in history. So even more names, for instance, Sun Tzu, author of The Art of War. Many elements in that book foreshadow elements of realpolitik. Thucydides, a Greek historian, wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. A lot of the writing in that history is also very pragmatic, realistic about it. An early Indian statesman named Chanakya, author of the Arthashastra, which is another treatise on statecraft and political science, which again, kind of outlines this political realism thing. So, you know, Rachow was not the first person to put these ideas forward. He was simply the one who coined the term realpolitik and kind of consolidated all of these ideas into a post-Enlightenment, post-monarchy kind of statement that the modern, at least modern Western world has embraced. Other names include, of course, Niccolo Machiavelli, in The Prince. Much of The Prince is, you know, the entire question of is it better to be feared or loved, and the advice given in The Prince about how to achieve both. It is very amoral, right? It does not concern itself with what might be morally right or wrong. It is simply, here is how you seek and gain power and maintain power, mm-hmm. right or wrong. Other people like Cardinal Richelieu in France, Thomas Hobbes, the English philosopher, Frederick the Great, Karl von Clausewitz, Mao Zedong, right? Plenty of leaders mm-hmm. and influential people throughout the world have exhibited these kinds of ideas. I mentioned Sun Tzu. That goes all the way back to what is known as the Spring and Autumn period, which is from about 771 to 476 BC. And this was when a trend of realistic reformers advanced their interests in the Qin state, which then founded the first Chinese empire under the Qin dynasty, ending the Warring States period. And of course, later on in China with the revolution and Mao Zedong, a lot of these very powerful movements were able to occur because the leaders and the people who followed them were willing to pursue the goal rather than prioritize the ideal, right? The ideology. I already talked about Otto von Bismarck, right? Unifying Germany, which is its own thing. The Singaporean statesman Lee Kuan Yew served as the country's first prime minister, has been considered by many to be a pragmatist for his erudite policies and governments of Singapore. He believed that Singapore could only survive as a relatively small nation as compared to its neighbors, and in order to do that was to contrast itself from them by building up a highly effective and non-corrupt government in addition to civil service under a meritocratic system. Of course, you know, in Europe, in the United Kingdom, there have been people who have argued for realpolitik. In America, you know, more relevant to us and those of us listening to the podcast, in the 1960s was really when American realpolitik began to like take hold. The guy I mentioned, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was a Polish-American diplomat and political scientist. He was national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, and he proposed peaceful engagement with the Soviet Union, which was, his arguments were in direct opposition to the McCarthy era, you know, anti-Soviet kind of thing, and John Foster Dulles's talk of military liberation of the Eastern Bloc. His attitude was that we should engage in peaceful ways with the Eastern Bloc nations rather than promoting anti-Soviet propaganda. He felt it would be more successful to have frequent interactions with regimes and people under communist rule. And the realistic view was these people are committed to the Soviet Union because of history, not because they actually care about the ideology, right? So if we show them another way that actually works better, it will be a realistic evolutionary alternative to empty political rhetoric. That was a quote from him. Henry Kissinger also was a proponent of realpolitik as he was Secretary of State for Richard Nixon. He believed in dealing with other powerful nations in a very practical manner rather than on the basis of political doctrine or ethics, which, like, that's one reason Nixon went to China as the first American president to, like, recognize and go to the People's Republic of China, among other things. We even see it in Pakistan. Jimmy Carter desired to improve relations with Pakistan. You know, obviously, the Iranian Revolution was happening. Pakistan had recently executed President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and so tensions were strained, especially also because Pakistan was developing its nuclear program and the U.S. didn't necessarily like that, but they, you know, under Carter with this realpolitik kind of approach, the attitude was, let's not worry about the, you know, the rhetoric of who believes what and whatnot. Let's look at the reality of Pakistan and the role that it plays in the region mm-hmm. and all of that. So anyway, those are a bunch of examples of realpolitik appearing in the real world. In fact, a lot of President Obama was even referred to as someone who's rather realpolitik rather than, mm-hmm. you know, ideologically driven. He was a very practical and pragmatic president in his approach, which, of course, alienates people within your own party, you know, when there are Democrats who are very much concerned with what it means to be a Democrat and what you are and what you aren't and the things that that should mean rather than with the necessarily effects of the decisions you make. Right. So yeah, it's a thing. It's not a historical term. It is very much a real, like, real world term right now. And it's not an ideology is the thing. It's like, yeah, it's very, it's like much the opposite. Yeah. It's like, it's just an approach, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a consideration. It's a viewpoint rather than a political ideology. So there we go. That's realpolitik.
Cool. That's helpful. I feel demystified.
Good. Me too. All right. Are you ready for a quiz? Because now I am.
All right. I'm ready for a quiz.
All right. So this is based on 6 different names of people that I found associated with Realpolitik through my research. Sometimes it's actually about the person. Sometimes it's just kind of related to the name. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. But somewhere in each of these clues, whether it's in the answer or in the clue, one of the names of the people in the deep dive will come up. Except this first one. I don't know if I actually mentioned his name, but it's okay. His name isn't super important.
Okay.
Here we go. Question number one. Ibn Khaldun wrote a profoundly influential 14th century book called Muqaddama, and it influenced thinkers for centuries. It covered topics including sociology, religion, political theory, and philosophy of history. It is also considered a precursor to what mostly debunked and derided misapplication of a 19th century biological theory.
I feel like we're somewhere in the eugenics area, but I feel like eugenics is like not specific enough or not quite right.
I'll say you're on the right track. It's 2 words.
Okay. What is that called? Is it something evolution? No. Let's see. Something selection. No. Survival of the fittest. 2-word term. Sociology. Wait a second. Is it social Darwinism is coming up? Is it social Darwinism?
It is social Darwinism.
Ah!
Very nice.
I knew it lived in my brain somewhere.
I could tell you like you were circling around it for a long time. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Social Darwinism is the, I'm going to editorialize a little bit, but the very adolescent sort of perspective that there are people in a society who are stronger and more fit to survive and thus deserve to survive and prosper while others do not. We, as, you know, fully grown adults who can think, know that that's not true and that that's not why people succeed or fail within a society, that it's far more complicated and there are far more factors outside of their control. So social Darwinism was a very popular theory after, you know, Darwin's natural selection, everything, you know, became widely known and accepted. He was also very much opposed to applying Darwinism to humans. Mm-hmm. He was like, no, that's not how it works. But people didn't care. So at this point, though, most people, you know, most intelligent people don't buy into social Darwinism. Mm-hmm. Nice job. You're at 20 points.
Yay.
Question 2. Sun Tzu is best known today as the author of The Art of War, though that is historically questionable. That's for a different time. Another book with the same title was penned by another author, much later and across the world. This second Art of War was the only one of his books published during his lifetime, even though he is now associated much more commonly with a different writing of his. In fact, that work was so influential that his name became an adjective encompassing the arguments and practices laid out in that work. Who was that author and historian who was always happy to serve?
I think always happy to serve must be a clue, but it's not connecting for me. Author and historian? You didn't say a country or an era, right?
I did not. I'll say it was about 800 years later than The Art of War.
Okay.
I'll say it's Renaissance.
Okay, cool.
And I don't know if that helps.
It's a little straightforward, but I'm just going to go Machiavelli.
Well, that's good because it is Machiavelli.
Yay.
Yeah. He wrote a book or a treatise. It's a book called The Art of War, which is what it says. It's basically his take on how a leader should execute a war. And it was, which I thought was really interesting. It's the only book of his that was actually published during his lifetime. Like he wrote The Prince and kind of circulated it among his close like associates and obviously to the leadership that he wrote it for. But it was never actually like published until after his lifetime. Yeah. Which pretty quickly with that publication and The Prince becoming widespread, Machiavelli very quickly, even by the end of the 16th century, the term Machiavellian and his name became associated with that kind of amoral, power by any means kind of attitude. Nice. All right, you're at 30 points. Question three. Speaking of Machiavelli, he has appeared in countless examples of Western popular culture. In the Elizabethan era, he was often portrayed as amoral or sinister, though his character has shifted through the centuries. In one example from 1589, a Senecan ghost named Machiavel orates the prologue, during which he derides religion as childish and states that the only sin is ignorance. This sets up the tragic tale of The Jew of Malta by what playwright?
It's not Shakespeare. And so if it's not Marlowe, I don't know who it is.
So you're going with Marlowe?
I'm going with Marlowe.
That is correct. That's exactly the reasoning I hoped you would use. Because I was like,
I know and one of them, I know all his titles. So
exactly. That's exactly what I was hoping for. Because I was like, I don't know how to give a clue without saying outright that it's not Shakespeare. It's the other one. Yes, it is. Yes, The Jew of Malta is a play by Christopher Marlowe. It was written before The Merchant of Venice. And some surface level criticism could say, like, oh, well, Shakespeare stole his story from Marlowe, just like everything else. But really, if you compare the stories, they're actually very different. The characters, the main character of Marlowe's play is Barabbas. His, like, personification, his characterization is very different than Shylock. So a straight up comparison between the two would show that there may have been a small bit of influence, but it's not like one was taken from the other. There is a little bit of question about the actual authorship, whether the entire thing was Marlowe or it was, you know, partially or whatever. I feel like that's the case for like anything written of that time, though. It was like, well, we're not sure it was all written by one person. It's like, okay, what does it matter?
Yeah. I mean,
the bigger deal was it was very much an example of like the anti-Semitism of that particular era and the manifestation of that at that time. Anyway. Nice. Christopher Marlowe. All right, you're at 40 points. Question four. A Chinese cultural and anti-imperialist movement, which grew out of student protests, was named for the date that those protests started on in 1919. Mao Zedong was one of the many gathered in front of Tiananmen to protest the Chinese government's weak response to the Treaty of Versailles. However, the force was not with them that day, since the Communist Revolution would be decades later. Which date gives the name of this movement?
May 4th.
It is the May 4th movement. I had no idea how to give a better clue than that.
That was good. We had the force clue in there, and that was what I needed. So I've never heard of the May 4th movement.
Yeah, it was a student protest. Apparently, the Treaty of Versailles allowed Japan to retain territories in the Shandong region that had been surrendered by Germany after the siege of Tsingtao in 1914. And of course, the students were upset that, like, Germany lost. Why does Japan? That's our land. Why does Japan get it? Right. And naturally, you might not know this, but tension between China and Japan did not ease over the next 30
really?
Years. Yeah, right. So there you go. Yeah, May 4th movement. Nice. All right. Question five. You're at 50 points. Robert Ballard is an oceanographer best known for discovering the wreck of the RMS Titanic. He is also the first to discover the wreck of what World War II battleship? It was the largest and most powerful of its time when it launched in 1939. It sunk HMS Hood in 1941 before being hunted down by the Royal Navy in an operation that spawned a 1960 movie and same-named country song. And I will just say Robert Ballard is not the name from the deep dive.
Okay. Country song?
Yeah, it felt weird. It goes with the movie. The song is like part of the movie. They go together, but apparently it like charted. It was a big hit.
Huh. Okay. I can never remember the ships I'm supposed to remember that have sunk and which one is which. I keep waiting for people to miss them on Jeopardy.
But so we can talk about them.
So we can talk so that then I'll have to learn them. Mm-hmm. But other people seem to already know them. Okay, there's Remember the Maine. There's the Lusitania. That's all of them. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to go Lusitania.
Okay, I'm pretty sure Lusitania is not a battleship.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. It's not at all.
This is the Bismarck.
Oh, okay. I have so the movie, heard of that.
The Bismarck was the, like, it was the biggest dreadnought at the time when it was launched. There was actually apparently a Treaty of Washington or something like that. There was like a naval conference after the First World War in which the former Allied powers determined that there should be a limit on how big you can build a ship. It's kind of like a way to limit a potential arms race. And so technically the Bismarck was within those bounds. But it was like at the limit. So it was like the biggest, heaviest, most powerful battleship ever built up to that point. Mm. And then the movie in 1960 is called Sink the Bismarck. And
oh, okay.
So it was the song. Of course it's named for Otto von Bismarck.
Just yeah.
Saying. All right, you're at 50 points. The final is literature.
Okay. I'll wager all of them.
Okay. I am going to need at least 3 or 4 names for the answer for this.
Oh, no.
I think it'll be okay. Cardinal Richelieu was an important political figure in Renaissance France, but his actions and policies did not endear him to many of the French people. He will remain immortalized in fiction as the antagonist opposed to what title characters?
It's the Three Musketeers. And you're going to need 3 or 4 names. And I've got 2 of them. There's Athos and Porthos. And then the other one. And then the one of these things is not like the others.
The one that's not actually a musketeer.
Yeah. I think the third one that's actually a musketeer, I think, is going to escape me. But I'm going to be able to get the name of the other one. I think it's like the band that makes the pants.
Yeah, it's like the duck yeah, brand. Yes.
Yeah, D'Artagnan.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give it to you. You got three of them. You know, it's the Three Musketeers. You got it. Yeah.
The other one. I know so Athos, many more Porthos. musketeers yeah, than Athos, I used to.
Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. Aramis is the last one, and then D'Artagnan is the one who wants to be a musketeer.
Okay.
And gets like taken in. Yeah. D'Artagnan, yeah. I think, is actually the main character of the story.
Huh. Okay.
Nice. But you got it. Yeah, you knew who I was talking about. You got it. You got 100 points.
Yay. I got 100 points.
Oh, and you worked for some of these.
Yes.
You worked for some of these answers. It was like you did good.
This was a fun quiz. This was great. Well, thank you, Kyle, for podcasting with me, as always.
Course.
And thank you, listeners, for spending your time with us. You should subscribe to our podcast. There's a little button. I always forget to hit the button. Do you guys forget to hit the button? You probably forgot to hit the button.
Like, you could hit the button.
Hit the button. And hey, you want to really go for it? You can tap that little leave a review button or whatever, and then like write one single sentence that's like,
yeah,
it's a good podcast or something. Maybe give us a star rating.
They talked about Triscuits too much. You know, who knows?
We do talk about
whatever
Triscuits
you want
too much.
Whatever you want to
Our Patreon, as we discussed, is patreon.com/potentpotables. Kyle's going there to put up these excellent quiz questions.
Yes, I am.
You like to watch Jeopardy. So do your friends. Tell them that there's a great podcast about Jeopardy.
You and your friends. Can all find us on Facebook at Potent Potables, on Twitter at Potent Potables 1. Our email address is potentpotablescast@gmail.com, and our website is potentpod.com.
And we'll be back next week, hopefully a little bit more combobulated with a little bit more Jeopardy. Five more episodes of Jeopardy and another deep dive and quiz. So until then, may your minds be quick and your buzzers be quicker. Mm-hmm.